loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we look at the big stories of the week. We'll continue our regular segment called The Week in Review by discussing the workers' actions against the government shutdown that are going on today, the LA teacher strike, the ongoing U.S.-backed coup effort against Venezuela, the arrest of Roger Stone, and much more.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, longtime Republican Party operative Roger Stone was arrested in a pre-dawn FBI raid on his home in Florida this morning. He was charged with seven felonies, including witness tampering, obstruction of justice, and five counts of making false statements. Stone was arraigned in federal court at 11 o'clock this morning, and his attorney said he would fight the charges vigorously. Then Venezuela's judicial, political, and military leaders backed President Nicolas Maduro yesterday as the U.S.-backed coup attempt continued. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo urged member countries of the Organization of American States to back Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido as president and refused to accept the decision by Maduro to expel the U.S. embassy staff. Street mobilizations by supporters of the government are continuing in the face of violence by opposition supporters. Next, Marzia Hashemi, the American citizen who is a journalist for Iran's Press TV, was released from federal custody after testifying before a grand jury. Hashemi had been held without charge as a material witness to force her testimony. She was subject to a variety of degradations while being held. And finally, again this week, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines.
And in other headlines, hours after air traffic controllers called in sick, shutting down major U.S. airports, the Trump administration has been compelled to agree to end the government shutdown without the funding he demanded for the so-called wall at the U.S.-Mexican border. The deal will keep the government funded for 3 weeks, will allow for back pay for federal workers, and will set up a bipartisan committee that will start work on a Homeland Security legislative package. Voters in the southern Philippines approved the creation of the Bangsamoro region, a semi-autonomous zone for the country's Moro people. The creation of the Bangsamoro region was part of a deal to end the long-running insurgency by the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. There are still smaller dissident groups that reject the deal with the government, however. The Taliban has named a new head of its political office in Qatar, Abdul Ghani Baradar. Baradar is a co-founder of the Taliban, and his appointment is being interpreted as a signal that the organization is giving increased weight to the negotiations carried out by its representatives in Qatar. The United States is represented in these negotiations by former U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan and Iraq, Zalmay Khalilzad. Two Palestinians were allegedly throwing stones at cars in the occupied West Bank today when Israeli troops responded by shooting them with live ammunition. They killed Aman Hamed, a 17-year-old. The other Palestinian was wounded. Reports are that they were throwing stones on the main highway in the West Bank that Israeli settlers use. Those are today's headlines, and you are listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to our weekly segment called The Week in Review. We pre-recorded this segment earlier today. We talked about the week in politics, policy, and international affairs with Jacqueline Lookman, who joined us here in the studio. Jacqueline is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we were also joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. We talked about the mounting pressure on the Trump administration to reopen the federal government, and specifically the actions taken by workers at airports throughout the United States and other major topics. Jackie, Walter, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Glad to be here.
As we talk, there is a full ground stop at major airports in the United States because air traffic controllers and others are calling in sick. They might be sick, but I think they're sick and tired of not being paid. Anyway, Jackie, this could be big.
Yeah, this is already big, actually, because there are no flights in and out of LaGuardia.
And not just LaGuardia.
Yeah, not just LaGuardia, but Philadelphia and Newark as well. But interestingly, though, CNN says that the union is going to treat this like a major storm. So sometimes storms pass. flights can start taking off again. Sometimes storms hang out for a long time.
So who is going to direct those flights if there are no air?
There may be a storm coming, and the storm is called a lot, hundreds of thousands of angry working people who realize that even though many of them have to work and many of them, all of them are not being paid, it's a consequence of a bogus initiative by the Trump administration to do something that's completely unnecessary. Gratuitous is too soft of a word, to spend $5.7 billion for a wall. Again, a wall that Donald Trump during the 2016 campaign insisted Mexico would pay for. Anyway, people are getting angry.
Yeah, people are getting very, very angry, and as well they should. And not only are we seeing the massive sick outs, I know that they can't call them that because
they can't call them a strike.
They can't call them strikes. They can't call them sick outs, but we can.
I'm coming down with something. It's associated with not being paid.
Yeah, it's called I can't pay my rent.
Yeah, that syndrome. I can't pay my rent syndrome.
And not only is this going on with air traffic controllers, this is also going on with IRS workers who staged a very polite, I thought, protest yesterday, and other federal workers across the country. So this is not just as the Trump daughter-in-law said the other day, you know, just 800,000 people going through a little minor inconvenience. And it's bigger than them. No, now it's huge, and it's affecting everyone, because now we're talking about international flights out being grounded out of three of the largest hubs in the country. And we're also talking about contractors and the businesses that service all of these federal agencies and the people who work for them, dry cleaners, restaurants, barbershops. All these other businesses, grocery stores in people's neighborhoods, people don't have money to support these businesses. And now we're not only seeing the effect in the economy, but also just in regular travel. So now it's starting to hurt us all.
That's the voice of Jacqueline Lookman. We talk to Jacqueline every Friday in this segment called The Week in Review. We also talk to her on Wednesday when we look at In the News, which is a sort of a midweek look at the big stories. We're also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. Walter is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show, Loud and Clear. John Kiriakou, we have angry workers. We have angry air traffic controllers. At the same time, there was yesterday two measures in the Senate to reopen the government, a Democratic measure, a Republican measure. Both failed, and so the stalemate continues. Do you sense a growing sort of fraying at the edges, or maybe even inside the edges, in either the Republican or the Democratic Party camp?
I do. I think the Republicans are beginning to fray. There was a Republican caucus lunch yesterday. That's where all of the Republican members of the Senate get together. They do this every month. And the majority leader, in this case, Mitch McConnell, lays out the plans for the coming month, the legislative plans. They invited Vice President Pence to address the group yesterday. And by all press accounts, this was an angry luncheon.
How did Pence get time to do that when he's the new leader of Venezuela?
He's the leader of Venezuela, exactly.
Anyway, go ahead. Sorry for interrupting.
No, that's okay. Pence took it on the chin, but so did McConnell. A lot of these senators blame McConnell. The primary one was Senator Ron Johnson, who's a very conservative Republican from Wisconsin. And according to the Washington Post, McConnell snapped back, "Do you think I'm enjoying this?" McConnell has a phrase that he's become famous for relative to government shutdowns, and that is that there's no education in the second kick of a mule, meaning he knows how painful these shutdowns are for the Republican Party, because it's always the Republicans that insist on the shutdown, and it's always the Republicans that get killed in the polls once the shutdown begins. Well, the same thing has happened yet again this time. Now, the Republicans led a shutdown, specifically Ted Cruz led a shutdown in 2013 that lasted 16 days, and the Republicans got killed in the polls because of it. It's worse now, but McConnell doesn't have the guts to stand up to this president. One final point of these two bills that were voted upon in the Senate yesterday, the Republican bill attracted one Democratic senator, that's Manchin of West Virginia, who's pretty much a Republican anyway. And it attracted, not it attracted, but it it saw two Republicans defect to the Democrats and vote no. So it lost 50-50. The Democratic bill picked up the votes of six Republican senators. Six. Now, if five more peel off, that's enough to invoke cloture. And so I think if I were Mitch McConnell, I would start to really worry right now that I'm beginning to lose control of my caucus.
If Trump doesn't approve of the measure ahead of time, he's going to veto it.
He's going to veto it.
No matter what.
Yeah.
Correct?
And so it would not reopen the government anyway, but it would show the chaos that we're beginning to see in the Republican Party.
Walter Smolarek, again, this morning, air traffic controllers calling in sick. We had people from TSA calling in sick. Right around the corner here in Washington, D.C., there are long food lines. They'll form again soon. And again, we're recording this segment earlier in the day. They're going to be forming soon. And it's going to be well-dressed people in suits and ties standing in line for a long time to get free food. Wilbur Ross, the billionaire, yes, another billionaire in the Trump cabinet, shocking, Secretary of Commerce, said he couldn't understand why people would be standing in line. I mean, they could always just get another loan, maybe refinance their house if they're hungry. But that's Wilbur Ross. It's kind of like Marie Antoinette.
Yeah, I mean, it's becoming increasingly clear that the government shutdown is a form of class warfare waged by the rich against working people. I mean, yeah, of course Wilbur Ross would have no idea why people would have to stand in food lines because he's a billionaire, because he's never had to do something like that in his life. And Wilbur Ross is a particularly odious type of billionaire. I mean, his nickname was the bankruptcy king, right? So he would come along and buy failing companies and fire, you know, a big part of the workforce and screw everybody over and then, you know, return it to profitability for himself. Donald Trump, too. I mean, he's a big fan of not paying people. That was kind of what he was known for in his real estate business. Yeah, I mean, these people don't care at all. You know, the only thing that they want to do is advance their careers. They want to build this ridiculous racist wall along the U.S.-Mexico border so that they can get reelected next year. And they don't care at all if working class people are suffering, if their families are suffering, if their communities are suffering. And now what we're seeing at these airports is that finally people are fighting back.
Yeah, and I just want to add real quick. Look, if this does not build a working class solidarity across sectors in this society, if the fight for 15 can't build a solidarity with federal workers now, and if they can't build federal solidarity with the contractors who work in their buildings to clean their buildings and do their lunch and actually do some of the work, and if we can't, as a working class group, build solidarity with the teachers and the firefighters, then we're doomed in this country. Mm-hmm. If this does not build a unilateral working class solidarity across all sectors in this country, we are doomed.
You know, let's just segue then and use that as the transition to talk about something else regarding labor that was big this week. And of course, that's the settlement of one of the biggest strikes in recent U.S. history. 30,000 workers, that would be the teachers of Los Angeles and other people on the professional staff, went on strike for 6 days. A settlement was reached. The workers felt great, most of them. I mean, there was a very, very super majority that ratified the contract. I was struck, Walter, by the media coverage in the LA Times, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and across the board in the corporate-owned media, which of course would mean the capitalist-owned media. And again, these are not just media, they're corporations. And they're corporations who have workers, and they don't want their workers to get the idea that striking might be a good idea.
Sure.
So they're really making it look like this strike was a terrible failure, even though there was all this enthusiasm by the workers. Now, in any union strike, you don't win everything. That's the nature of a collective bargaining agreement. If you think about it from the point of view of bosses and workers fighting, a collective bargaining agreement is a truce. It's a treaty. It defines the terms by which you will work, what's your rate of pay, what's your benefits. You don't get everything. It's like a treaty, like all treaties, unless one side is so strong that they completely crush the other side. There's give and take. There was not in complete 100% victory for the teachers, but this was a victory. They think it's a victory, but the media coverage, again, by corporations, is like, oh no, this was a bad idea.
Yeah, it was a success on two fronts, I think. One being just the things that were the direct demands of the strike, in the sense that You know, there are big victories won in terms of class sizes. There were big victories won in terms of hiring more staff to make schools more safe, you know, like nurses, also librarians, people who, you know, enrich the educational experience for their students. There's significant victories on pay, too. I mean, there is a cumulatively 6%, right, pay raise. But then there's a bigger context of where the struggle is coming from, which is the fight against the privatization of public education. This struck such an important blow against the privatizers. I mean, Buettner, the superintendent of the LA school district, is a finance capitalist. He's a hedge fund manager. He's not an educator. And so, you know, the fact that he had to give these very substantial concessions to the teachers union, I think really strikes a blow at all of the people like Buettner who are sort of salivating at the U.S. educational system as a source for new profits. And, you know, the teachers in Denver voted to strike. There's going to be a big demonstration, I believe, this weekend in Virginia, organized by the teachers union there. So this is, you know, a movement that's continuing.
Again, on the issue of worker solidarity, the interesting thing that corporate media is not reporting about the LA teacher strike is that there was that unilateral kind of worker solidarity because the firefighters union came out with fire trucks and they loaded their fire trucks up with teachers and teachers' aides and signs. And they got out there in support of being very, very visible in support of the teachers. Not only did the firefighters union support the teachers in this strike, but this was the result. The strike itself was a result of years and years of grassroots education that was done by the union. So the community, there was like 80% support for the striking teachers in the community, and that includes the students. So you're right, Brian, nobody wins everything they want in a strike, and that's just realistic. But the LA Teachers Union has developed, and I don't think it's not the first time, but they've laid the groundwork in the modern era for the kind of grassroots organizing that unions need to do. You can't just go on a strike and win some stuff and then go back to business as usual. You have to continue to engage the community and explain to them why your union is important, why fighting for workers is important, and how we go about these things as we go forward.
You know, and you raise a good point too, Jackie. And I think it's an important one. Whenever there's a teacher strike, and we saw this just in the past 12 months in West Virginia, North Carolina, Oklahoma, now Los Angeles, Arizona, the public always supports the teachers. Always. Why? Because they know that the teachers get screwed. They know that teachers don't make enough money. They know the average teacher's $1,500 out of pocket for basic school supplies. You know, you see these bumper stickers that, you know, wouldn't it be great if the Pentagon had to hold a bake sale just to provide basic things that the teachers end up having to do? When your child goes to a public school and has to hold a fundraiser just to buy, you know, basketballs, footballs, maps, dictionaries that have the words astronaut and cosmonaut in them because the ones that are in the libraries don't because they're that old, then you have a problem. And the public realizes that.
Indeed, they do. And I also want to make the point that this strike was preceded by 21 months of negotiations. That's a long time. That's almost 2 years. That shows a couple things. One, it shows that the teachers did not want to strike. They negotiated and negotiated and negotiated even without a new contract. They kept negotiating until they couldn't negotiate anymore. So the strike was a measure of last resort, an act of last resort. Two, in the course of those 21 months, and anyone who's been involved in union organizing knows this to be true, as workers go through a process, their consciousness changes. And that's the most important thing. A strike does not happen sort of all at once. A strike is the culmination of a process where people learn, their expectations go up. Oh, we're going to get a contract. Then their expectations are dashed. They're promised something, the promise is taken away. The union starts to hold a demonstration and a rally. And then the people, you know, the first time people who don't demonstrate, I'm not one of them because I've been demonstrating so long, but when you go to your first demonstration, a lot of times people are embarrassed. Like, I don't want to be out here holding a sign. I don't want to be handing out leaflets to a stranger. So then the workers are compelled to go out to that rally or to that informational picket line or to something that gets them out in the public. And then they have their first sort of interaction with public organizing, and it feels good. You're not embarrassed. You got people honk their horns for you when you hold up a sign. You started to see your coworkers. Somebody else felt weak, and you talked them into being stronger. Like, you go through these experiences. So by the end of the day, after those 21 months or whatever length the process is, and this is key to grassroots, rank-and-file union organizing, the workers have changed. They feel stronger. They feel empowered. They feel ready to fight. Then they do it, and they strike. And instead of being crushed because they don't have a paycheck or crushed because the media and the courts rule against them, instead of that happening, they actually win. Again, not everything, but they've gone through that process and they feel they achieved something. From that moment forward, that workforce and that labor movement is in a stronger position. And that signals all the other workers who have started at the same place, afraid, intimidated, embarrassed. They all learn the basic lesson, hey, this opens up the door, the possibility of another way of changing the political equation. Here, John Kiriakou, you and I talk every week to Bill Ayers in this segment called Education for Liberation. And he wrote that new book, 18 Myths About Teachers, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones, et cetera, et cetera.
That's right.
That has been the dominant narrative, what Walter talked about, the need to privatize, public schools are a failure, teachers are the problem, et cetera, et cetera. This strike and the other strikes from the past year change that narrative.
Absolutely.
And that, to me, is the most important part of a struggle. It's like, because the struggle is about empowering people who have power but don't know they have power. In order to do that, the narrative has to shift.
I think that's absolutely true. And that's how you, and I know a lot of younger progressives don't quite understand, but that's what revolution is. It really is the foundation of revolution. That's how you change society. It's really how you change politics. You start from the bottom and you change people's consciousness about their reality and about the reality of other people. And that helps people find common ground. And then they find a reason to fight for each other. It becomes bigger than, well, my personal issue of not having a paycheck. Now it becomes an issue of, wait a minute, they're screwing me over. So what are they? They're screwing you over too. And none of us are getting what we want. What can we do about it?
I want to make one more segment on this before we go to other issues. 40 years ago, a capital in America, the corporations, the hedge funds, like the guy who's in charge of the LA schools, they went on an offensive against the labor movement. And it took different tack. One tack was to move factories outside the United States. Mm-hmm. A second was to get rid of basic union creeds, like the idea that we're all in this together by introducing two-tier pay, meaning workers who were there and had seniority get a higher pay, the new hires get a lower pay. That was a big demand by the bosses, because that way you divide the workers. You, instead of having a common interest, you have a divided interest. And then there was just the all-out offensive against labor organizing, where even if you sign up, even if you get 80% of the card signed for union representation, you hardly ever win, because then you have to go through this long, long process with the National Labor Relations Board. It's an election process. But during that, say, year before the election, the bosses are basically saying, well, if you vote union, we might shut down. If you vote union, you're going to have to pay a lot of money in union dues. If you vote union, that means you're not going to be treated as an individual with your own meritorious ability to rise through the ranks. You're going to be treated as part of a herd. They do that offensive, and then the union, in spite of the fact that you start strong, you end up weak. That's what actually has happened, and the labor movement has been weakened. Now we see the possibility of the revival of the American labor movement, but unlike 40 years ago, where it was industrial labor, this is service sector labor. Instead of it being male-dominated industrial labor, it's female, it's occupations where women are the majority. And so there's a shift, there's a change in the composition of the labor movement as we historically knew it. More women, more people of color, more in the service sector workers, unions. When you look at this trend, it's unmistakable.
Yeah, this is, I think, where we have to be careful that we don't lose this momentum in connecting these struggles. And women are usually kind of good at that, right? I hate to disparage you guys, and I don't mean to, but women just in a very kind of general sense, we're very good at looking at the lay of the land and being able to gauge, okay, this affects all of us. And I think that's part conditioning. That's just kind of how we're conditioned. I don't think there's anything special about our DNA. That's just kind of how it's a part of how we're nurtured to see and understand how things affect other people. Where men generally in this society really aren't. Men are nurtured, conditioned to be very individually focused, very individualistically primal drive to just do for self and one's own. So when you have a labor movement that is infused with women and people of color who are used to being marginalized, we see these connections a lot more easily than a lot of men do. And we're a lot more willing to go out and say, okay, this is a problem. We have to deal with the intersectionality of these issues, where for a lot of men, that's not an automatic kind of thing.
Yeah, Walter, let's end this segment on this subject. It seems to me to be, if you look at things big picture and the trajectory of politics, I think this could be perhaps one of the most important features of the new era. Again, the unintended consequences caused by the decisions of capital, by the decisions of corporate management, nonetheless, a new day in the labor movement.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that, you know, the broader radicalization that's going on in society, I mean, there's been, you know, a series of, you know, really big mass movements over the course of the past, I don't know, 10 years or so. I mean, we can think, okay, there's the Occupy Wall Street movement, there's the Black Lives Matter movement, there is sort of, you know, whatever its limitations were, the explosion of enthusiasm around Bernie Sanders, which sort of took the form of enthusiasm for the concept of socialism. And now we have, you know, the labor movement rising, and I think that could give a lot of people sort of a productive and concrete outlet for these new radical ideas that are becoming much, much more popular in society.
That's the voice of Walter Smolarek. We're talking to Walter, who is a producer of this show and also a Sputnik news analyst, and we're talking with Jacqueline Lookman about the big issues that have happened this week. It's really stunning to me. The news is so dynamic. We just talked together last 2 days ago on Wednesday for these stories midweek. But here we have a new breaking news. And again, I would say I'm glad we began this segment with the discussion of what's going on at LaGuardia, what's going on at the other major airports, because workers and the people who are required to make airplanes fly, they're getting sick and tired of not being paid. Anyway, you're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
We're talking this week, as we do every Friday, in a segment called The Week in Review. We talk about the week in politics, policy, and international affairs with Jacqueline Lookman. She is in studio, and she is also the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Jackie, Walter, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to be here.
Well, in the first segment, we talked about the government shutdown, the fact that workers, especially workers at airports, are getting fed up about not being paid. We also talked about the impact of the Los Angeles teacher strike. Let's start this segment with another really major news story from this week, and it's a story that isn't over. It's gone through some ups and downs and ebbs and flows already, and more will definitely be coming. But the Trump administration has decided who the president of Venezuela is, except the people in Venezuela haven't agreed yet. Go ahead, Jackie.
Yeah, the Trump administration, through, I think first it was Pence and then it was Mike Pompeo, who made this ridiculous speech about, you know, the illegitimacy.
Hola, I'm Mike Pence is how he.
Yeah, I'm here for democracia.
It was so horrendous.
Wait, you think that's not compelling for people in Venezuela?
It's about
Hola,
as
I'm Mike Pence from Indiana.
It's about as compelling as hot sauce in a purse.
And
I
Jackie,
guess.
Jackie, you posted something on Facebook that was so telling. You posted two photos next to each other.
Yes,
talk about that.
I'm looking at that right now. So the argument, the focus of these people in the Trump administration is the illegitimacy of the assembly of Maduro, which is the constituent assembly. And if you look at the pictures, and I hope we share on Sputnik, the constituent assembly is made up of 90% people of color?
Yes.
From the Venezuelan constituency.
It looks like Venezuela.
It looks like Venezuela. The National Assembly, which is the illegitimate assembly of this Juan Guaido person, it looks like the Hamptons. I mean, it really does. I'm not, it really looks like
a Donald Trump cabinet
meeting.
It
does look like a dinner at Mar-a-Lago. Yeah. So the Trump administration is claiming that Guaido and his National Assembly are the legitimate leaders of Venezuela, but nobody voted for those people. Nobody voted for Guaido in Venezuela. They've been the administration has been claiming that the elections have been were illegitimate, that propelled Maduro to his second 6-year term. They said that before. There have been previous coup attempts in Venezuela that, of course, the corporate media doesn't talk about. And people are making a big deal about, socialism in Venezuela is why, the Venezuelan government is a disaster. And this has been the running narrative for a while. But what people don't talk about is the interference of the United States and Saudi Arabia in the Venezuelan government nationalizing oil profits, gold profits, and food processing to benefit the people of Venezuela, and rejecting a quote-unquote free market capitalist system that would allow private companies to benefit mostly from those industries. That's been the problem in Venezuela. Not to say that Maduro is a great guy, but as far as the economy is concerned, we're talking about a Chilean-style, make-the-economy-scream, Milton Friedman, Nixon kind of economic coup that has been going on.
Yeah, Walter, we were outside the Venezuelan embassy on the night of the attempted coup launch, and there were people who were supporting the right of the Venezuelan people to determine their own destiny, to have self-determination, to have independence, and also to support the Bolivarian process initiated by Chavez and that revolutionary movement that Maduro is continuing to redistribute the wealth so that before, 1% of the population owned 70% of the land. Venezuela was a rich country with many, many poor people, the majority. There's been that sort of effort to reshape society so that there's actual social justice. I was out there and the media was saying, what about Nicolas Maduro's human rights records? What about the idea that he's not the legitimate president, et cetera, et cetera? And I'm thinking, like, here's Mike Pence saying that Nicolas Maduro is not the legitimate leader of Venezuela because he didn't win a free and fair election. I mean, of course, the Trump administration, the Trump campaign lost the popular vote in the United States by 3.6 million. Trump, nonetheless, having not won a free and fair election except through the Electoral College, is the president of the United States. But moreover, who is Donald Trump or Mike Pence? Hola, Mike Pence, to tell the Venezuelan people who their leader is when Nicolas Maduro was in a national election. One part of the opposition boycotted that election. That's the right wing, the super right wing, who Pence and Trump have now said is the legitimate leader of Venezuela. Another part of the opposition, the moderate opposition, didn't boycott. They participated. And Maduro won. I mean, Jimmy Carter has said, and there were many, many other election campaign observers, that Venezuela's election process is free and fair. As a matter of fact, he's extolled it for its virtues. This idea, this narrative provided by Donald Trump and Mike Pence, now echoed over and over and over again by the media, including even people like Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, people, like Donald Trump and Mike Pence are talking about constitutional legitimacy in Venezuela. They're so concerned about the democratic order, the constitutional order in Venezuela. But the people saying that don't know the first thing about the government of Venezuela or Venezuelan society. So there are five branches of government in Venezuela. There's the legislative, executive, and judiciary, which we know from the United States. But there's two additional ones. It's called Citizens Power. So that's basically like the anti-corruption and auditing arms of the government. And the leaders of all those different departments that are involved in making sure that the government runs cleanly, they sit on something called the Republican Moral Council. And then there's the National Electoral Council, which is also a full co-equal branch of government. And so what happened with the National Assembly, this is the reason why the National Assembly is illegitimate and Nicolas Maduro is legitimate. So after, they won the election in 2015, the government immediately recognized that the opposition won the election, which is something that the opposition almost never does when the government wins. But, you know, they canceled the election, the results of the elections, in order to rerun in one of the southern states of Venezuela, because they said that politicians there were engaged in vote buying, right? So the National Electoral Council, co-equal under the constitutional order to Venezuela, in Venezuela to the National Assembly. But the National Assembly said, we're going to seat those legislators anyway. We don't care. We're going to seat them because, you know, most of the people whose elections were canceled were opposition members, but one was a government supporter. And so what the Supreme Court said, again, a co-equal branch of government under the Venezuelan constitutional order, said, you are in contempt of court. The National Assembly is in contempt because they're refusing to obey the National Electoral Council. And so any decisions that you make are null and void, right? Because you're in contempt of court. It makes perfect sense. So, you know, the country needs its legislature to function, and there's a provision in the Venezuelan constitution that allows for the convocation of a constituent assembly, which can assume legislative powers and rewrite and amend the constitution. And so that's exactly what happened. It's all completely 100% legal. And by the way, unlike the U.S. constitution that was written 240 years ago by slave owners, the Venezuelan constitution was written in 1998, 1999, and ratified by a popular vote of the Venezuelan people.
John Kiriakou, this has been a remarkable few days. It looked like all the momentum was going with the coup on Wednesday, because you had Trump announcing that Guaido, the 35-year-old, a speaker of the assembly, somebody who most Venezuelans don't even know, I mean, truly don't know. Now they're supposed to go out and maybe die for him in the street battles. Again, not maybe a great pick there. But anyway, it looked like the momentum was with the coup, because you have the United States, the biggest, most powerful economy and military in the world, all behind it, right?
And Brazil and France and a couple of other big countries.
The Lima Group.
The Lima Group as
Canada.
Well.
Canada.
Except for Mexico, St. Lucia, and
Uruguay.
Uruguay, that's right.
Yeah, so it looked like, wow, momentum is on the side of the coup.
Yeah.
Then the next day, yesterday, Guaido, the new president, is still in hiding. He won't come out. And the U.S. is saying, well, all options are on the table. They're threatening basically military action. A Yankee invasion of Latin America. Wonder how that would work out.
Right.
And then at that amazing meeting in the assembly, the secretary of the defense minister in Venezuela, the head of the military, says we're 100% with Maduro. And then you start to see the momentum of the coup start to fray. Where was the planning here by the coup makers, by Washington?
Yeah, you know, this is such an important point. There was no plan for day two. And the funny thing is that, geez, I hate to even speak these words because this sounds so awful. But when we plan to overthrow a government, there's a lot of planning that goes into it. Usually, the situation spins out of control, as you can see in Iraq and Afghanistan and a whole host of other places. But with that said, there's a plan. They have these things called principles committee meetings where it's chaired by the president. You have the vice president, the secretaries of state and defense, the head of the CIA, the national intelligence director, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and they come up with a plan. And then the details are hammered out by their deputies in what's called the deputies committee. Clearly, nothing like that happened here. The White House had a bee in their bonnet to overthrow the Venezuelan government. We think, and we've discussed this on the show, that it was to divert attention away from the Mueller probe and the government shutdown and other domestic problems. But there was literally no plan for day two. One of the traps that American policymakers, imperialist policymakers, fall into, and I saw this with my own two eyes before the invasion of Iraq, is they just assume that as soon as we make an announcement like this, or as soon as the first American soldier crosses a border, that the local populace is going to throw flowers at them and get on their knees and thank them for liberating them. And that's never what happens. You know, these signs in the subway, there's a picture of a guy looking at an abandoned bag and it says, it's never a bag of money. You know, if you see something, say something. It's the same thing here. They're never going to throw flowers at you. They're never going to welcome you as a liberator. They're going to look at you as an imperialist, as an occupier, as an invader of their country. And there's nothing different about this situation than there was with any of those others.
Jackie, I think it's so important what John is saying. It's the imperial fantasy. It existed like in 19th century where the Americans or the Brits or the French or the Dutch or the Portuguese or the Spanish or the Italians, one of the imperial powers, the colonizing powers, could just roll in, say, to Haiti or Brazil or an African country, and by force of arms, they were going to take it, right? They were going to take it. They could talk, and they did talk. If you look at the speeches of American congresspeople or American presidents in the 19th century, or the Brits or the French, it's filled with this kind of arrogant colonial language. It's going to be our destiny, our manifest destiny. But guess what? We're not living in the 19th century. And the people in underdeveloped, emerging, formerly colonial countries have become empowered. They are not colonial slaves. They don't accept this proposition. They're motivated. They've been motivated for decades, for more than a century, because the fight for independence has gone on that long. And they're not going to easily, as John put it, get down on their knees or have any inclination to throw flowers at those who are coming in to take over their country.
Absolutely. And what you were saying, John, is so important, because I think in this country, we believe we're the only people on the planet who know about our horrible history of imperialism and regime change. Other countries have seen what we've done. And the Venezuelan people and people in other countries that are mineral rich, they understand their worth. They understand the worth of their land, and they understand the right they have to self-determination without the interference of any other power. They understand that even though they might not agree with their own elected officials all the time and the way their elected officials do things, they understand that they have a right to determine their own future without anybody in another country telling them what is best for them. They may not understand the ideals of imperialism and colonialism, but they know when they're being bullied. And the people of Venezuela understand that they've been bullied by the United States and its partners for a long time, to the point that the Venezuelan military yesterday, and I think the video is on Telesur, did a televised speech, like you said, Brian, coming out in support of Maduro and blatantly saying, if the United States invades or attempts a coup, this will be your Vietnam in Venezuela.
So he did say that.
He absolutely said that. So I mean, these are not people who do not understand our horrible history of imperialism.
But look what we're up against, too. Adam Schiff, who I just loathe because I think he's a fake. Adam Schiff is the new Democratic chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. Adam Schiff bills himself as Donald Trump's worst nightmare. Those are his words. Donald Trump's worst nightmare. This is one of the so-called leaders of the opposition. He tweeted yesterday that the coup attempt in Venezuela, quote, is an appropriate step. An appropriate step. This is the opposition party here in the United States and the chairman of the Intelligence Committee. This is what we're up against. Because this imperialism, this neoliberal expansionist ideology, is rampant across government in both of the major parties. They really believe that expanding overseas and overthrowing governments is a good idea.
Yeah, the two political parties are a two-headed imperial monster. And you could see that they differ with Trump because they want the White House. The Democrats want the White House. They want the spoils that go with being the head of state. I mean, there's like literally trillions of dollars of contracts. If the Democrats win, the contracts mainly go to Democratic donors. If the Republicans win, then they go to Republican donors. I mean, it's a very, very big lucrative business paid for us, we the people. But they're both united around imperial designs and a commitment to imperialism. Let's go back and just talk about the grossness, the grotesqueness, the brazenness of the language being used by Washington right now. Here's Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State. And this is Schiff, as John is pointing out, the opposition, who says this is an appropriate response. Really? Let's listen to Mike Pompeo's actual words before the Organization of American States. Quote, former President Nicolas Maduro does not have the legal authority to break diplomatic relations with the United States or to declare our diplomats persona non grata. That was Mike Pompeo talking yesterday at the OAS. So the U.S. Secretary of State says that Nicolas Maduro does not have the right to break relations with the United States while it's staging a coup against the Maduro government.
Against a democratically elected president.
And Adam Schiff, the second head of this imperial two-headed monster called the American Political Party Alignment, says that's an appropriate response.
There's total unity on this question. We also saw it when Donald Trump attacked Syria for the first time. You know, yeah. He's finally presidential. He's finally acting like a president. And you know what? Maybe that's true. Maybe that is how presidents of the United States are supposed to act and have acted historically. But yeah, there's almost total unanimity. I mean, there are a couple statements that were from individual congresspeople that were like, okay. But yeah, by and large, by its overwhelming majority, there's been no criticism, and it's including from the mainstream media, of these types of brazen interventions. You know, they've been talking endlessly about, oh my God, in 2016, there was foreign interference, there was Russian interference in the U.S. election. But now that there's the most blatant form of, like, imagine if Vladimir Putin declared, okay, Bernie Sanders, you are the president of the United States right now. And Bernie Sanders said, yes, I am. And the army should rise up and put me in the White House. Like, can you imagine what would have, that's effectively what the United States has done to Venezuela.
What's the Ola equivalent for Russians? Ola, American. Your new leader, Bernie Sanders. Well, talking about Bernie Sanders, I don't think he did that well on this one.
No, he didn't.
No.
Bernie Sanders tweeted, "The Maduro government has waged a violent crackdown on Venezuelan civil society, violated the Constitution by dissolving the National Assembly, and was reelected last year in an election many observers said was fraudulent. The economy is a disaster, and millions are migrating. The United States should support the rule of law, fair elections, and self-determination for the Venezuelan people. We must condemn the use of violence against unarmed protesters and the suppression of dissent. But finally, we must learn the lessons of the past and not be in the business of regime change or supporting coups as we have in Chile, Guatemala, Brazil, and the Dominican Republic. The U.S. has a long history of inappropriately intervening in Latin America." That's kind of soft. "We must not go down that road again." So after sort of giving way on all of the reasons why the coup is legitimate, Bernie Sanders says, but wait, let's not do the same thing that we did in the past. That's not a principled opposition. Now, listen to the voice of Tulsi Gabbard, who is another member of the U.S. Congress. And again, you can have all kinds of criticisms of Tulsi Gabbard. But what's unique about what she said is how alone she is in what she said. Mm-hmm. Here's what she said. "The United States needs to stay out of Venezuela. Let the Venezuelan people determine their future. We don't want other countries to choose our leaders, so we have to stop choosing theirs." I mean, that seems to just make obvious common sense, and by the way, would be in conformity with international law. The U.S. government, it's illegal in carrying out a coup attempt against another sovereign country, another member state of the United Nations. You know, the defense minister, we're going to close on this part. The defense minister for Venezuela said to the Venezuelan people yesterday when he confirmed their support, the military support for Maduro, he said the idea that Guaido is now the president of Venezuela would be laughable. That was his word. Except that this is a serious problem, not because of Guaido, because the United States, the most powerful military and economy in the world, seeks to snuff out a Venezuelan democracy in the name of Venezuelan democracy.
Yeah, and it's particularly obscene given the way this soft coup, what they call a soft coup, has been going on in support of the United States and Venezuela for a couple of years, where the violence that has been committed by opposition forces under Guaido, who have been attacking pro-Maduro protesters, has just resulted in so much unconscionable violence.
It's the opposition that has carried out systematic violence, and it looks trained. I believe they've gotten training, paramilitary training,
I don't doubt it.
I'm using air quotes.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. And I think that's just incredibly hypocritical that this government is supporting this Guaido person in the wake of all of this organized violence from the Maduro opposition. When, you know, people can't protest in this country without being, you know, targeted by the FBI.
John Kiriakou, there was a really dramatic military-like raid on Roger Stone's...
You can say that again.
...dwelling in Florida. I mean, 6 a.m. in the morning in darkness, military gear...
Fatigues.
Looks like a war...
Helmets.
Roger Stone is now indicted on charges of lying. The Mueller probe has indicted Roger Stone, who is described in the indictment, it's a 24-page indictment, as a former Trump official or an official in the Trump campaign. We want to talk about what his real role was there. But when you look at the indictment, it's actually not about Russia at all.
No, there's
it doesn't even mention
whatsoever.
Russia.
No.
It's about Roger Stone lying to the House Intelligence Committee about his emails, I think.
Yeah, that's exactly what it's about. And threatening our friend Randy Credico. I mean, these are what we're talking about, seven separate felonies, and they're almost entirely about lying to the House Intelligence Committee. First of all, let's talk about this raid on Roger Stone's house. Roger Stone has known for weeks that he was likely to be indicted. And friends of his say that he had been holed up at home all week this week, waiting to be arrested. So sure enough, at 6 a.m., the FBI does what it does, always at 6 a.m., because you're sleeping and you're not expecting it and you don't have time to grab a gun, et cetera, et cetera. And so they went wearing military fatigues and bulletproof vests and military helmets. They beat on his door, shouting, "FBI, open up, FBI warrant." And Roger Stone opened the door in his bathrobe and pajamas and gave himself up. So he was charged with seven felonies, five counts of making a false statement to Congress, one count of obstruction of justice, essentially. It's obstruction of an ongoing federal investigation, and one count of witness tampering, which relates to Randy Credico. And so he was arraigned this morning at 11 o'clock and he pleaded not guilty. His attorney said that he would vigorously fight against these accusations, and he was finally released. But this is bad. Now, the interesting thing about Roger, and we've talked about this before, is that Roger had nothing to do with this Mueller investigation. Nothing. But he has this, and this is my word, he has this pathological need to be the center of attention. And so he inserted himself in the middle of this thing by lying and saying that he had been in touch with Julian Assange, that Julian Assange had told him that there was a major data dump coming that would wreck the Clinton campaign, that Randy Credico was his back channel to Assange, etc. None of that was true. None of it.
He was desperately trying to get information from somebody who then he pretended was an intermediary between him and Assange. That's also clearly, from the indictment, not true.
Yes.
He even says that the Trump campaign wouldn't return his calls.
Right. He complained about that.
He complains about it. It's in the indictment.
Yeah, it's in the indictment.
So Roger Stone is a trickster, a fraudster. He's been doing dirty tricks.
Oh, since the Nixon White House.
Yeah. I mean, that's his shtick. He's a conservative Republican trickster, fraudster guy who's always trying to get in the media. So, Walter, as we knew back in the summer and in the fall of 2016, WikiLeaks was making proclamations that they were going to release documents. That was not a private matter. Then Roger Stone was trying to, it seems like, impress the Trump people by saying,
that's what it was.
Look, I'm the guy who can tell you what's coming next. So he hears in public there's going to be a new document release, and he says he wants to call the Trump people and say, look, I've got the inside story about what WikiLeaks is going to release about emails related to John Podesta or to Hillary Clinton. That's what this is. And then when he went before the House Intelligence Committee, the same committee that he's now indicted for lying to, he was mocking them. He was like throwing darts at them He was antagonizing them. Now he's indicted again, not for lying to Mueller and not for colluding with Russia, but for lying to the House Intelligence Committee when they asked him, do you have emails and texts about this matter? It looks like Roger Stone said no,
right,
in his defiance. And in fact, there are texts and emails about the fact that he was hunting for some information and not succeeding related to WikiLeaks. That's what it looks like.
Yeah, and I think this is not unusual in terms of how insider politics in the United States works, right? Like people sort of bluff their way into rooms and into, you know, important positions and into positions of authority or perceived authority. And, you know, I think it's the same thing when we look at the Paul Manafort trial, right? I mean, it's like Paul Manafort is not the only lobbyist doing financially shady things. But because, you know, the U.S. has such a shady political system that sort of exists in the fringes of legality, the Mueller investigation is able to sort of pick up whoever they want to build this narrative. And that's what it's really about, building like a political narrative that, you know, holds Donald Trump responsible for some type of collusion with Russia, even though Russia is like 100% absent from the indictment that we've been reading.
Sean Kiriakou, Roger Stone, again, the guy is a true character. He's, as you said it, a pathological.
Fabulist,
right? But these are seven felonies. These are heavy, heavy charges. It seems like with this many felonies, just for lying to the House committee about whether he did or did not have emails and texts, it's designed to make Roger Stone plead guilty to something lesser.
You're exactly right. It's designed to make him flip, presumably against the president. He has said repeatedly that he would never testify against the president. And so eventually he's going to have to take a plea with no sentencing recommendation. The bottom line is that Roger Stone's going to go to prison. It's probably going to be a minimum security prison camp, a work camp, but he's going to prison.
Again, even though the Mueller probe is about collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, and this is not about that, clearly, when you go out in the studio right now and turn on MSNBC or CNN or the others, if you're like the lay public, meaning the people, you could not but come to the conclusion that this is sort of a confirmation that, in fact, there was collusion. In fact, everybody, actually read the indictment. It doesn't say that at all. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We've been in our segment called The Week in Review with Jackie Lookman. Jackie joined us here in studio. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we were joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Stay tuned.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.